Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Man, ambitions to set out and find, like an odyssey, you're going home somewhere. I'm set out to find this home that I'd left a while back, and couldn't remember exactly where it was, but I was on my way there, and encountering what I encountered on the way was how I envisioned it all. I didn't really have any ambition at all. I was born very far from where I'm supposed to be, and so I'm on my way home.
How does it feel to be on your own, with no direction home, a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? Yes, the unmistakable words and music of the great Bob Dylan, taken from Martin Scorsese's 2005 documentary film, No Direction Home, which chronicles Bob Dylan's evolution from folk troubadour to iconic rock star. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. How fluid is identity? Is there such a thing as psychological truth? And is Bob Dylan the Shakespeare of song? Well, tonight on Talking Books, we're going to unpack those questions with writer and teacher Dr. Andrew McCarron, author of Light Comes Shining, The Transformation of Bob Dylan, where Andrew writes, "We all have scripts that play out in our lives. Real or imagined things happen and produce sets of emotions, thoughts and behaviours that are often repetitions and therefore predictable. Many of Bob Dylan's personal stories of transformation are redemptive in form and in theme." Andrew goes on to write, "The goal of this book has not been to gauge the depths of Dylan's changes across the various levels of personality. Did Dylan change at the levels of dispositional traits and characteristic adaptions, or were his changes primarily on the narrative level? So who exactly is Bob Dylan, and how has he defined the American spirit?"
Hello, my name is Andrew McCarron. I've always been interested in studying exemplary lives. When I was in graduate school the first time, I was studying theology, and I became very interested in Christian hagiography, the study of the lives of the saints. And then I thought, oh, wow, it would be interesting to write in this sort of idiom, but looking at modern lives. So I went off to a doctoral program, and in that program I focused on psychobiography and the study of lives. And I wrote my dissertation on the lives of three poets who live in New York City, two of whom are still living. And after that, I wanted to continue that sort of work. So I wrote this psychobiography on Bob Dylan. And it took about, I would say, about 4 years to complete. I love finding out as much as I can about artistic vocation and the various creative processes of artists. And I have been listening to Bob Dylan and going to as many shows as possible, probably for about 12 or 13 years. So I figured I would do something really challenging and try to write on Bob Dylan's life, using some of the tools that I had learned about in graduate school. So that's a brief backstory to the history of the composition. I'd wanted to write about John Ashbery or Jack Kerouac first, but then I ended up deciding to throw caution to the wind and submitted a proposal for a psychobiography on Bob Dylan, and it was accepted, which was a thrilling moment in my personal and professional life.
What a stunning biography, Light Comes Shining, The Transformation of Bob Dylan, Andrew, and what an unbelievably complex and challenging subject to write about. I have to say, I learned so much reading this biography, not just about Bob Dylan, but also about the human condition, because you really probe at life and truth and what it means to be human in this biography. I might start tonight's chat with a big wide open question, if that's okay. Do you think now that Bob Dylan's somewhere now, I think in the mid 70s, do you think he's actually found personal salvation? Do you think that's possible for the likes of Bob Dylan?
Oh, that's a challenging question to answer. I've never met the man personally, whether he's found personal salvation. The restlessness that seems to still be present in his life suggests to me, at the very least, that he's on this dogged search for truth or personal salvation that will likely take him through the final period of his life, well, through the third act. So I think the desire certainly is present, evidenced by the albums that he continues to record and the touring schedule for a man of his age. You know, I'm playing upwards of 100 shows every single year. Pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. There's a restless quality that's been consistent and that I associate with, or I assume is to be associated with his desire for salvation or full realization of one sort or another.
You quote W.B. Yeats's iconic poem, Among School Children, how can we tell the dancer, or how can we know the dancer from the dance? And it got me thinking that we've got so many different Bob Dylans. And I'm wondering, is Bob Dylan an invention of his own mind? Like, could it possibly be? Because he has presented himself to the world, to his fans, and to many people in his life as a range of different types of personas.
Well, I mean, to a degree, I think one thing that captivated me, continues to captivate me about Bob Dylan is I think that his life underscores how, at least in potential, we are all products of our own mind. To borrow from William Blake, right, we're mind forged. I think that his life suggests that those deterministic anchors and those moorings that keep us fixed in one identity need not be the way that life is experienced. And I think for creative people, artists, and people with specific spiritual orientations, this sort of experimental existence full of morphology and transfigurations is infinitely possible if the right conditions are present. One of my favorite philosophers, Ludwig Wittgenstein, wrote that to imagine a language is to imagine a form of life. I extend that quotation to the experience of being alive. We can imagine new realities and then inhabit those realities. I think it's, once again, this quality of Bob Dylan that I personally find to be just so incredibly interesting, and I don't think I'm alone. I think his life reminds us of something that's inside all of us.
Why did you choose a psychobiography as distinct from other types of approaches? I know we've had some monumental biographies of Bob Dylan. I know that you mentioned Robert Shelton's No Direction Home. But I'm just wondering, why did you feel that psychobiography was the way forward for Bob?
I think because you just suggested there's so much out there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of books on Bob Dylan. And it seems like there are scads of them coming out any given month. And I thought psychobiography would be helpful because it offers a range of approaches for dealing with especially complicated lives that introduce a gravitational center. And I thought that was the way in. that was a way to cut through some of the biographical paperwork, the thousands and thousands of pages. I think when psychobiography is done well, it doesn't try to explain everything about who people are and why they do what they do, nor does a good psychobiography reduce the complexity of life to a single theory. But it's after one or multiple salient themes of the life and some of the dynamics behind those themes. And if done well, I think it can really capture the psychological fingerprint of a person. So I chose psychobiography for those reasons, because it tends to be a little bit more focused. Some of the great biographies that have been written on Dylan are quite illuminating, but there's just so much to focus on. Maybe at times they lack, a center. So I went in there with a specific question in mind and tried to answer that question. And that question had to do with this trope of personal destiny that comes up so much in Bob Dylan's interviews. Whenever he has been asked to explain some of the decisions, especially some of the more perplexing ones in his personal and artistic evolution, he cited personal destiny, the sense of becoming the person, becoming the artist that he felt deeply inside that he was. So I wanted to focus on that specifically. So that was the organizing principle behind I Come Shining. I'm pleased with the results, although fully aware of the limitations. Mm-hmm. Psychobiography can be reductionistic at times, and that's something that I kept in mind through my own process, and hopefully I'm avoided at least to a degree.
You mentioned Freud pretty early on in the biography, who believed that, that lying was a form of truth-telling. And you argue that, when we lie, we reveal a lot of personal truths, and that our lies can reveal a lot more about us than our so-called true memories. Can you talk me through that?
Absolutely. I think this is especially important with Bob Dylan. A lot of the biographies that I've read have focused too much on whether he's telling the truth, and if not, trying to expose the real story. And from a psychological perspective, I think this can be a bit maddening. And you mentioned Freud, and Freud was definitely an influence in my writing of the book. And he believed that there was this difference between historical truth and psychological truth. And just as you suggested in your question, Susan, psychological truth, it's just less concerned with whether or not you're telling the truth, per se. It's really concerned with what you're saying and why. So that was my angle in terms of going into Bob Dylan's life, not to try to remain beholden to historical truth, but to try to figure out what his shucking and jiving during interviews across these many decades suggest about who he is as a human being and why.
I'm just wondering, we have so many books on Bob Dylan, and whether they're written from a fan's perspective or from a musician's perspective or whatever it is, that in a lot of ways it's almost increased his mystery, because there's so many different takes on him as well as what he's presenting to the public world. He's changed his tune on so many different aspects of his politics, his spirituality, his relationships, that there's so many different types of driving forces coming at the phenomena that is Bob Dylan.
Absolutely. And I think getting back to your earlier question, that's where psychobiography was helpful for me in my use of what's called script theory. And what script theory does, it looks across an individual's life narrative and tries to find scripts that repeat, so repetitive stories. And it really looks for truth in those stories. And by focusing on Dylan's interviews and his memoir from 2004, Chronicles Volume 1, I felt that I had evidence to suggest the presence of this destiny script, as I call it, in Light Comes Shining. That allowed me to anchor my analysis in something, given the proliferation of masks that he has projected and that have been projected onto him by just hundreds, if not thousands, of writers over the years. So, you know, I was keenly aware of all of the different Bob Dylans, but used script theory to put forward a possible candidate for one gravitational center in his psychological life.
You describe him as a prince of protean self-reinvention, and you talk a lot about, you know, his changeability as an artist and as a person, and also about his mercurial quality. And Bob Dylan has referred to himself as a transfigured person. And as you mentioned there moments ago, that he's felt very driven, that he's coming at life from this feeling of personal destiny. I'm just wondering, how do you explain all the transformations?
It's a great question. Eric Erickson, the psychological theorist who I drew from as well, believed that artistic people tend to be more protean than the rest of us. So that would be one explanation. I would also point to Bob Dylan's spirituality. I think that from a very early age, clear through to the present, he has believed in notions of transformation, transfiguration, as central to his self-understanding. I think perhaps that his historical situation and context also factors into the equation, especially given the degree to which he has spoken about the influence of the Cold War and his fears of nuclear annihilation. I think this probably propelled him to change fairly radically as an attempt to actualize who he was as a person and an artist with limited time, responding to the apocalyptic threat of nuclear war. I think all of these factors are present. You know, his identity as an artist, his spiritual identity, and his historical situation.
You quote Todd Haynes, who wrote, "The moment you try to grab hold of Dylan, he's no longer where he was." It's a brilliant way to look at it, isn't it? It's a brilliant way to look at Dylan because, you know, it shows just, it says so much about his malleability as a person as well as being an artist.
Absolutely. And some of that, no doubt, is the behavior of a wily performance artist. I'm sure he cultivates the slippery quality, but some of it, I think a good deal of it is quite genuine. You think about the phenomenon, once again, from a religious perspective, It makes more sense, whether it's the bodhisattvas of Mahayana Buddhism or shape-shifting in various shamanistic traditions, or the Catholic concept of transfiguration. This notion of fundamental change well into the adult years is a familiar one, I think, probably an appropriate lens through which to think about Bob Dylan, given his own spirituality, as he has alluded to throughout his life, through various traditions.
A lot of his fans were shocked when he converted to Christianity, and he went a completely conservative route on it as well. He joined a very small church set and deeply committed himself to biblical studies. And then his biblical studies slipped into his music, it slipped into his lyrics, it slipped into his live performance. But it clearly was, he at the time, it was authentically who he was. But he seems to have moved on from that all the same.
Yeah, that's what some people suggest. I think there definitely was a point maybe in the mid-1980s or so, maybe a little bit earlier, when he stopped making explicitly Christian statements about salvation and certainly about damnation come the apocalypse, Revelation. That being said, Christian themes of radical change and salvation and representations of Jesus, at least some allusions to Jesus, are still very much present in the music, whether we're talking about Tempest, the album, my goodness, I'm thinking right now of Red River Shore, which was an outtake from Time Out of Mind, Ain't Talkin', the final track off of Together Through Life. Yeah, these songs are deeply spiritual and draw from Christianity, draw from scripture regularly. So I don't know if his commitment to Christianity has completely dissipated. My sense is that he's just more careful about talking about it, probably because of the negative response through his explicitly gospel period from the late 70s into the early 80s. But again, that's just a guess. I'm just basing this on a study of lyrics and also a careful reading of the more recent interviews he's given.
You write that Dylan claims that he rarely listens to his albums and that once they're done, he thinks of them as snapshots of the real thing, which can only occur on stage. Do you think he's actually being honest there?
I think so. I think he comes from very much a folk tradition and is attracted to various folk traditions, not only the American folk tradition and live performance and the notion of a forever changing artifact sonically as performed live is near and dear to his heart. So my guess would be yes. I don't think he spends a lot of time listening to his own work. And his productivity seems to suggest this because whether it's original work or cover songs, as in recent years, he continues to be in the studio and then go out on the road for at least half the year. So I think he is focused on the art of live performance.
Do you not find it hard to believe that he doesn't maybe listen to All Along the Watchtower or I Shall Be Released every now and then? Possibly that, you know, that when he does improvise on stage, that can only be the point of understanding. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, you may very well be right. He's such an eccentric guy. Who knows, right? It's anyone's guess.
You argue the narrative of exile and return, which is so central to Judaism, has always played a role within Bob Dylan's life story and art. And I know you mentioned the Cold War earlier, but his grandparents came to America as exiles and were, you know, Jewish immigrants and had quite challenging and troubled existences. And do you think in some way that has shaped his identity and that his feet have never felt firmly on the ground due to the fact of the kind of the historical lens that he's bringing into it all?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think the answer is yes. I think the experience of being culturally Jewish and, as you mentioned, coming from an immigrant family, I think led to an internalization of the Exodus narrative from a young age. I do know that his uncle ran a bunch of movie theaters, and I've always imagined him watching as a young child some of the news clips of the liberation of the concentration camps, and I think anti-Semitism in Europe and in America, and images of the Nazi Holocaust, most likely factored into this feeling of rootlessness and restlessness that I imagine is Jewish in many respects. I mean, when he was in New York as a young man, he didn't go out of his way to proclaim his Jewish identity and change his name, of course, from Robert Zimmerman mm-hmm. to Bob Dylan. And his friends didn't know he was Jewish.
It's odd, though, isn't it? Can I ask you, you've a very interesting chapter, Andrew, on Dylan's 1966 motorcycle accident. And at the time, you referenced the fact that he was taking a lot of drugs. He was drinking very heavily. He was very, very unsettled. And he was becoming increasingly more uncomfortable with fame. His life was spiraling somewhat out of control. And he has this accident, or he describes an accident. And he suddenly then goes on retreat to a doctor friend of his and lives a very solitary and private, secluded life for a while. And he publicly turns up again and creates quite a story about what happened. I'm just wondering, can you talk me through it? Because it's so unusual. Like, yeah. You talk a lot about psychic injuries, and this clearly was a psychic injury, as far as I can make sense of, for Dylan.
Yeah, that's my sense as well, and I'm certainly not alone. Many of his biographers, I'm thinking of Daniel Epstein, who wrote a biography entitled, I think, The Ballad of Bob Dylan, suggests that there really was no or very minimal physical injury, that Bob Dylan was wheeling this motorcycle that had punctured tires down a street in Woodstock, New York, and it was had just rained, so the road was slippery, and the motorcycle may have fallen on top of him, and he was being followed by his then wife, Sarah. So I think that there was no physical injury to speak of. Dylan has, is typical of him, has never really given a definitive answer, suggesting that he did injure vertebrae, but then also suggesting that the motivation, or rather the consequence of other things, really impelled him to go into a bit of a state of hiding, like exhaustion from touring, and as I mentioned in the book, drug addiction. Perhaps even more than that, I think the incursions of fame, probably the pressure of celebrity, all of this caused psychic injury. We were talking about Freud before. You know, I think it's beyond the pleasure principle that Freud suggests that the emotional injuries of the veterans he treated after the Great War, after World War I, were at times more distressing than the veterans than the physical injuries. And this notion of psychic scars definitely interests me. I also think of Emily Dickinson. Her poem, There's a Certain Slant of Light. I do have it here. I just want to read a few lines from it because I think it's applicable. There's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. I think that the inability to find a scar in this poem is reminiscent of probably what Dylan was going through around the time of the motorcycle accident in 1966, in July 1966. I think it's a hard thing to explain to people. We tend to ascribed to biological materialism. So I think that Bob Dylan found it easiest to suggest that there was some physical injury.
Andrew, you sprinkle some incredible interviews Dylan has given to a range of journalists through the years. And I'm just going to throw a few of them at you because they're so revealing in one way. And then in another way, they're a complete empty closure. So I'll just throw you a few here. One was in 1985. Okay. Bob Dylan gave an interview to Bob Brown from ABC. Bob Brown asked Dylan what he had to work out in life. And Dylan responded, "Well, you have to work out where your place is and who you are, but we're all spirit. That's all we are. We're just walking. We're just dressed up in a suit of skin. We're going to leave that all behind." And then he said a couple of years later to Rolling Stone, "I'm trying to explain something that I can't be explained. Some people never develop into who they're supposed to be." And it got me thinking that, you know, we get so many transformations, so many different types of Bobs. I think you describe it somewhere as in that Bob Dylan is in a state of constant becoming and he's evolving and becoming and becoming. And it's so you could piece together so many different interviews and have one Bob Dylan, and you could just throw some other interviews and have a completely different take. So that must have alone presented you as a psychobiographer with some moral and human dilemmas.
Definitely. It was challenging, but I think I just focused on the theme of perpetual changeability and restlessness of heart and the flux of life, and a desire to become who he feels he needs to become. That's remained relatively constant across all of these interviews and across his various periods as a person and as an artist. So I don't see multiplicity there. I think the various personas he's ended up creating are defined by multiplicity, but the impulse is fairly consistent from a young age, from his teenage years in Hibbing, Minnesota, until the present. You know, I think that we as people once again are potentially quite fluid at the level of identity, and that something deep inside of us, especially inside of artists, really wants to change.
You mentioned Blood on the Tracks, Dylan's studio album with Columbia Records from 1975, I think. And you talk about that was pretty much a biographical album. And I think a lot of people would agree with you on that point. It was when his marriage was dissolving. And he seems to have found fatherhood also quite challenging. So I'm just wondering how his music reflects his mental states or his honesty to what was happening around him.
Well, I think on that album in particular, I'm thinking of Tangled Up in Blue. Yeah. If you see her, say hello. There's so much estrangement, betrayal, forgiveness, hope, and confusion that runs through the album. It is quite reminiscent of the thick and muddle of strong relationships that end up disintegrating or becoming so complicated that they're irreparable. So I agree. I think that album is extraordinarily and perhaps transparently biographical, despite the fact that Dylan claimed that his personal experience was not the motivating factor. I believe he cited the plays of Chekhov as being the motivation for Blood on the Tracks, but I doubt that. I think that those songs really can be read as the biography of a relationship very much in flux.
Early one morning the sun was shining, she was lying in bed, wondering if she changed it all, if her hair was still red. If folks, they set their lives together, sure was it gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And he was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on his shoes, heading out for the East Coast, Lord knows he paid some dues. Getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when they first met, soon to be divorced. He helped her out of a jam, I guess, but he used a little too much force. And he drove that car as far as they could, abandoned it out west, splitting up on a dock that night, both agreeing on it was best. And she turned around to look at him as he was walking away, saying over her shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue, tangled up in blue. He had a job in Santa Fe, working in an old hotel, but he never did like it all that much, and one day it just went to hell. So he drifted down to New Orleans, lucky not to be destroyed, where he got him a job on a fishing boat docked outside Delacroix. But all the while he was alone, the past was close behind. He seen a lot of women, but she never escaped his mind, and he just grew tangled up in blue. She was working in a topless place, and I stopped in for a beer. I just kept looking at the side of her face, and the spotlight's so clear. And later on, when the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there right beside my chair, said, don't tell me, let me guess your name. I muttered something underneath my breath, she studied the lines of my face. Must admit, felt a little uneasy when she bent down to tie the laces of my shoes. Tangled up in blue. I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Hell, he started into dealing with slaves and something inside of him died. She had to sell everything she owned and froze up inside. And when it all came crashing down, I became withdrawn. The only thing I knew how to do was keep on keeping on like a bird that flew, tangled up in blue. So now I'm going on back again, I got to get to them somehow. All the faces we used to know, they're an illusion to me now. Some are mathematicians, some are truck drivers' wives. Don't know how it all got started, I don't know what they're doing with their lives. But me, I'm still on the road, heading for another joint. We always did feel the same, we just saw it from a different point of view. Tangled up in blue.
Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. I believe that ever since Adam and Eve got thrown out of the garden, that the whole nature of the planet has been heading in one direction, towards apocalypse. The words of Bob Dylan in an interview he gave to music journalist Mick Brown of the Sunday Times in July 1984. And yes, you've got it. Tonight we're unpacking the life and musical legacy of the great Bob Dylan with American teacher, psychologist and author Dr. Andrew McCarron from the Religion, Philosophy and Ethics Department at Trinity School in New York City, whose new book, Light Comes Shining, The Transformation of Bob Dylan, has just been published by Oxford University Press, where Andrew writes... Arguably, the biggest misinterpretation of Dylan's popular lore is the gospel years 1978 to 1981. Andrew goes on to state, from an outsider's perspective, it's hard to know where Dylan and the rumour mill of celebrity culture begins. I asked Andrew about Dylan's very public battle with addiction and whether it could be argued that his heavy use of heroin in the mid-1960s and other substances could explain his many personal transformations.
Yeah, I imagine they have. In my study of what's called fundamental change or quantum change as a psychologist, that is people who go through these born-again experiences, either once or multiple times in their lives, substances are often part of that equation of change. And becoming sober and identifying yourself in new ways and trying to give up the habituations of the previous addicted self, I think it really lends itself to transformation, or at the very least, the hope of transformation. And I would just echo what you intimate in your question. I think Bob Dylan's addiction to heroin as a young man, and then perhaps methadone afterward, and his struggles with alcoholism. I know he has been referred to by people as a raging alcoholic at times. I don't know if that's still the case, but I think it certainly was through multiple decades of his adult life. I think all of this probably factored into the changeability.
You also argue that Dylan is obsessed with death and disintegration, and you attribute this to his Jewish heritage and some of the unexpected events that happened in his own life. Can you talk me through that and how that obsession with death has somehow influenced his spiritual formation?
Definitely. He has always seemed to have this apocalyptic outlook, this obsession with death. And as I mentioned earlier, I think that this obsession has played a role in his dogged desire to realize himself before he runs out of time. I think the obsession with death was internalized from a young age, and as I explore in the book, I think it was a combination of the experience of the Holocaust. I think the Cold War played an absolutely central role. I mean, he reminisces in Chronicles Volume 1 of being, I guess, around the age of 10, and having to endure the air raid drills in Hibbing, Minnesota, where the kids would have to dive under their desks. he claims that this really this robs children of their spirit. It's no surprise then that when he converted to Christianity in an explicit way in the late 70s, maybe 1978, and began the program of Bible study, that the book in the New Testament that he was most intrigued by was Revelation, which foretold the end of human history by John of Patmos. I think that this has been a consistent thread in his life, and I think in moments of his more acute change, there usually is some sort of near-death experience or death threat, to borrow language from Freud and the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, that that impels him to change. The obsession with death is really everywhere. I mean, it's not hard to find once you look across the interviews and delve into the music.
Yeah, I think you mentioned there Robert Lifton. He talked a lot about annihilation anxiety, and this is something that you also feel that Bob Dylan suffers from.
I think so. Yeah, it's interesting because Robert J. Lifton, who's still living, is a few years older, maybe about a decade older or so than Dylan, maybe a little bit more, but definitely very much responding to the apocalyptic phenomenon of the Cold War. And Lifton believed that this threat was extraordinarily pervasive in the lives of conscious people, deeply internalized, and that one coping mechanism that Lifton suggests is this notion of proteanism, or the protean self. Robert J. Lifton believes that this is a postmodern character type, being able to shapeshift or assume multiple identities without completely fragmenting offers people some sort of psychological way of dealing with apocalyptic anxiety and the death threat as a pretty modern phenomenon in the nuclear age in particular. So the protean self is a source of strength and value. It offers people a way of escaping, I guess, the imminent threat of death and harm through recreation.
So, Andrew, having written this biography and sifted through the many dramatic events in Dylan's life, I'm just wondering, do you listen to his music, or do you understand his music anyway differently now? Because you've come close to his deep psychological self. So I'm just wondering, do you understand, or does the music resonate differently with you now, sit with you differently?
Yeah, it definitely does. I definitely listen to the music as more of a theological expression. The themes of rebirth and salvation, man's search for meaning and ultimate purpose, all of these theological themes, I suppose I was aware of, but as a result of doing all the listening and reading that I did to write Love Comes Shining, I realized just how central the spiritual and spirituality is across his whole corpus of work. There's this Saul Bellow quotation that I cited at the beginning. I think it's the beginning of chapter 2 that I'd like to read here. The dream of man's heart, however much he may distrust and resent it, is that life may complete itself in significant pattern, some incomprehensible way before death. And I feel that quotation is quite applicable to Dylan, and deeply spiritual, really, at its roots.
Clearly, Bob Dylan has had a desperate need for truth in his life, and a ranging and quite varied religious impulses also. Do you think it could be argued that possibly, whether it's fans, music critics, and so on, that have either loved or disliked his music to a degree, that ultimately Bob Dylan has been misunderstood?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think this religious piece hasn't been well understood. I think he's been looked at primarily through political lenses and also aesthetic ones. The notion that the spiritual quest, religious identity is present, has been recognized, but it's often reduced to just a cluster of years, thought about as something that was a prominent from the late 70s to the early 80s, and then like many other of Bob Dylan's identities or masks, ended up dissipating and being subsumed by new iterations. I don't see this to be the case. I think that Bob Dylan is a deeply religious person, and I agree. I think he's been largely misunderstood, especially by his contemporaries, by baby boomers in particular, who themselves might be largely atheist or just a little skeptical when it comes to religion. Or I don't know what it is exactly, but I agree with you. I think there has been consistent misinterpretation.
You end the book on a hopeful note, on a very insightful note, I might add. You write, maybe the more compelling, not to mention respectful, story behind who Bob Dylan is allows us to explore what his works and days teach us about having lived in the ragged edge of history that produced him. Such a story, needless to say, will take time to tell. But that's okay, because his songs will keep people interested long after the man born Robert Allen Zimmerman returns to the obscurity from which he came. I thought that was beautiful.
Hey, not bad, right? Yeah. I like it too. Thank you very much.
Well, on that note, what music should we end this evening's interview with?
Ooh,
there's so much to choose from. It's almost impossible. I find it even impossible to think what are the top 10 Bob Dylan songs, let alone the best. Or is, you know, can you even pick a best? But if there was one piece that really says for you who Bob Dylan is as an artist and as a man, what is that?
Well, I remember being an undergraduate and listening to Bob Dylan for the first time. In a new way, driving in the Catskill Mountains, actually not so far away, rather close to Woodstock, New York, and hearing the song Most of the Time off of the 1989 album Oh Mercy. And the song really had a dramatic effect on me. It's the song of an older man. Maybe he was around 50 when he recorded the song in New Orleans. And even though I was just about 20 years old then, there was something in his voice that I recognized to be so fundamentally human. It was almost as if I had a memory of the future, of my own future, through the song. So I would recommend playing that song from Oh Mercy, the song Most of the Time. I think there's a great deal of existential exhaustion and brokenness in it, but also a beauty and hope that points to future possibility. I also would recommend Every Grain of Sand off of the 1981 album Shot of Love, because I think Every Grain of Sand is incredibly beautiful and really speaks to the themes of spirituality and specifically recreation that we've been talking about over the course of the interview. So those would be my two recommendations.
Most of the time, I'm clear focused all around. Most of the time, I can keep both feet on the ground. I can follow the path. I can read the sign. Stay right with it. When the road unwinds, I can handle whatever I stumble upon. I don't even notice the sea gone most of the time. Most of the time, understood. most of the time. I wouldn't change it if I could. I can make it all match up. I can hold my own. I can deal with the situation right down to the bone. I can survive and I can endure. And I don't even think about her most of the time. Most of the time, my head is on straight. Most of the time, I'm strong enough not to hate. I don't build up illusion till it makes me sick. I ain't afraid of confusion, no matter how thick. I can smile in the face of mankind. Don't even remember what her lips felt like on mine most of the time. Most of the time, she ain't even in my mind. I wouldn't know her if I saw her. She's that far behind. Most of the time, I can't even be sure if she was ever with me or if I was ever with her. Most of the time, I'm halfway content. Most of the time, I know exactly where it all went. I don't cheat on myself. I don't run and hide, hide from the feelings that are buried inside. I don't compromise and I don't pretend. I don't even care if I ever see her again. Most of the time.
And that was teacher and writer Dr. Andrew McCarron. Light Comes Shining, The Transformation of Bob Dylan is published by Oxford University Press and retails for just under €20 in hardback. Now, I have to say, this biography is a welcome complement to the biographical works of Robert Shelton and Clinton Halen. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end this evening's broadcast with the beautiful words of Iranian revolutionary and sociologist Ali Shirati, who Andrew quotes in Light Comes Shining, The Transformation of Bob Dylan. Man is a choice, a struggle of constant becoming. He is the infinite migration within himself, from clay to God. He is a migrant within his own soul. How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.